Hello?
Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Hi, Anya.
Thanks for recording.
Not a problem.
Appreciate good morning.
It. Good morning.
Good morning.
University of Michigan is sitting in a conference room with Christine Kanaka, JJ, our fellow, and me.
Okay,
Jeff.
Great. Me sitting in my office at home hoping I'm not losing my connections. I was having a hard time getting in. I'm like, this is going to be a short journal club.
Were you part of this winter storm?
Nope, not at all.
Oh, good.
Yeah, no, we haven't. We haven't went below zero. We haven't even went below 10 so far.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it's been a really warm winter.
Wow, it's practically like living in Sioux Falls. How are the animals adjusting to global warming?
Well, I don't have any animals anymore.
Are you serious?
No, we downsized dramatically. So I'm down to chickens and 3 rabbits.
Oh, my God.
The dogs and the cats, of course. But
Yeah, right.
But even then, we lost a few to old age, so.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
Good morning. This is Andras.
Oh, hey, Andras.
Morning, Andras.
Morning.
Is that Henry?
Yes.
Oh, hi.
You have no animals anymore?
No. No, downsized.
Well,
we're kind of refocusing. The cows were too big. The pigs were breeding. I had too many chickens.
Did you know that when you bought them?
Pardon me?
I'm just joking.
Oh. We might try ducks.
Ducks?
Next spring, yeah.
All right.
Okay, so it's 8:16 by my clock, so maybe we could get going. So, for those of you who have looked at the material ahead, there were several articles on mesothelioma this month, so I decided to make a theme out of it. It seems like the IALSC is taking on mesothelioma. So they had a first consensus paper published this month, and there's more to come. There was one in the last month also. They kind of want to go over all the overall gaps of knowledge or science within mesothelioma and I think try to at least start with getting consensus paper for everybody to do things in a more standardized way until we fill these gaps in, of knowledge. So the first one is really a very high-level, broad review and consensus statement regarding everything, the genomics, the therapies, whether it's an early stage or unresectable mesothelioma, standardization for clinical trials, and so forth. So it's an interesting read, emphasizing these areas of gaps, which are also areas of potential research. As it belongs to or as it pertinent to us in pathology, I think what they were focusing on was areas where we can standardize our pathology reporting and panel of biomarkers that are used, all the areas where we could have translational studies as part of the clinical trials for early and unresectable malignant mesothelioma, focus on what are all the biospecimens we should think about collecting and how we should collect them, especially in the era of next-generation sequencing, and really expanding the translational correlates a bit beyond what we have traditionally done. Usually it's pre, maybe during treatment, but they're also emphasizing post-treatment and progression of disease. This is not just tissue, of course, but also pleural effusions and blood, and kind of developing the standards of procedures for collecting these specimens. And also, how do we store and process these specimens, and what is the metadata to be associated with the specimens collected? So So a lot of things for us to look at, and I know there is one pathology consensus paper that's been put together already and should be coming out. So we'll see several of those coming out, and I guess it'll be up to us to try to see if we can put that in place. It also means for clinical trials, maybe more engagement from pathologists to participate in these clinical trials. There will be, I think, opportunities to look at deeper in the science of that disease in a more standardized fashion. So that kind of sets the stage for the rest of the articles I'll be discussing. Any comments?
Do they have any pathology authors on this consensus?
Yeah, they did. They did. I don't remember who it was, to be honest.
Okay. I couldn't find
it. I think maybe not on this one.
I think Ming Chao is under.
Yeah, Ming is there. Fred Hirsch, who's kind of a bit of both. So those were the two main ones.
Okay.
Thank you, Anya.
Fred Hirsch is another pathologist, is he?
Yeah, exactly. And the pathology consensus.
Fred Hirsch is an oncologist.
Well, he does both. Yeah, he's really an oncologist, but he does more lab work now. Yeah. But the pathology paper coming out has a lot of pathologists on it, of course. So.
Okay.
So more to come. Okay, so that was kind of setting up the stage. And the next paper I'm going to discuss is, I guess, the one I like the most of the papers on mesothelioma, which was the pathology grading of malignant pleural mesothelioma, an evidence-based proposal from a group out in Italy. And basically, the work they did remind me a bit of the work that was done for solitary fibrous tumor and kind of coming together with a predictive grade based on different parameters. So it was a multi-center study. It is retrospective, and they had quite a bit of patients in the study, almost 1,000. And they divided their group of patients in a training set where they identified the various parameters to use in their grading system. And once they kind of had put together their grading system, then they used twice as many patients, almost twice as many patients, to then validate their study. They have, of course, various demographies, staging, type of treatments, type of specimens included in their chart abstraction. They used overall survival for their prognostication, not disease-free survival. And basically, each diagnosis of malignant mesothelioma and the subtype was confirmed by two pathologists. And on the first round, they collected a lot of different parameters, which included, you know, the percentage of necrosis. Well, if there's necrosis, the percentage of necrosis, the subtype, of mesothelioma, the cell atypia that they just divided in three grades, if the nucleoli were inconspicuous or distinct or micro, mitotic count, and K67 labeling index based on hot spots. And they also looked at comparing the reproducibility between two pathologists in 128 cases for all these parameters, because their goal was to use parameters that were reproducible, so to make their scoring system more reliable, basically, in terms of predicting outcome. So the clinical pathologic characteristics of these patients are detailed in the Table 1. There was no surprise there in terms of being mostly older males, and they had some missing information, which, again, I guess it's not surprising just because it's a retrospective study. But mostly, like, in terms of whether or not there was asbestos exposure, treatment, they didn't have information on all the cases for treatment. But, of course, for the pathology, which becomes important for the multivariate study, of course, but at least they could do the pathology assessment on all the cases. They had the material to do so. The differences, what was important is at least the differences between the training and validation set seem to be similar. It's just that they didn't do any P statistics to confirm that, which kind of is important if you're going to validate your cohort. That's here nor there. Then they, between epithelioid and biphasic, the epithelioid was the most common subtype, and or biphasic with predominantly epithelioid component. A third of their cases had necrosis, moderate to severe atypia, more than 50%. K67 labeling index was superior to 30% for the most part. And mitotic activity was usually above 3 mitoses per millimeter square. So based on their inter-observer variability study, they excluded from their scoring system cell atypia and nucleoli, which is not surprising. We could have predicted that. And then they did, based on the overall survival, multivariate analysis to identify the parameters to include in their prognostic score. And based on that, it was necrosis as absence or present, not the percentage, just if it's there or not. The subtype, epithelioid and biphasic lumped together versus sarcomatoid. K67, below 30 or above 30. And then the mitotic count, which they divided in multiple tier, 1 to 2, 3 to 5, 6 to 9, or 10 and more. And then using that, they modeled using this scoring system. And basically they had really, they developed a parameter that actually predicted the scoring. So they would assign points. Again, very similar to what we do now with the solid tumor fibrous tumor. On the point, is everybody there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I thought I was losing people. Sorry. So based on the assignment of, they could actually use this to predict 12-month mortality, and it was better than just K67 or mitotic count alone. And in fact, once they had their whole score, they had three distinct survival curves with median overall survival, 26 versus 12.8 versus 3.7. And in their validation, that fell a little bit, but it still has three distinct cores based on the scoring. So I thought it was potentially something to use down the road, I guess, in terms of a predictive scoring system. I mean, the survival is not great no matter what, but it still kind of highlighted three groups of patients based on the way they scored. And it's easily done. It seems to be reproducible. I guess something to consider using moving forward. Any thoughts?
How did K67 correlate with mitotic index? Mitotic rate. What's that?
They didn't say. They just said, they just kind of compared their overall score versus mitotic count alone or versus K67 alone, and they said that the overall score was better than each alone, but they didn't go into the details of how they, based on the curve, they look quite similar. So if you go to figure 2, for example, you'll see that in blue you have the PGS score, which seems to be, that's the area under the curve, basically, graph. And the PGS score seems better than just mitotic count or K67 alone. And when you look at those two curves, they look quite similar. So I'm sure the correlation is probably excellent. But the point was that their score was better than either alone.
You referenced the index that's been proposed for solitary fibrous tumor. Is that something you routinely report in your pathology reports?
We do.
It's clinical elements, right? And
Yeah, two of the three. Well, we use a DeMichael, if I'm saying her name correctly, and two
are
clinical.
Yeah, there's more than one, I think.
Yeah, and that's the one we've used. Jen had done a nice study, kind of looking at thoracic solitary fibrous tumor and using all the scores to compare the results, and they were pretty equivalent. So we went with the easy one to use in our practice, and it's the one that has the two clinical score and the mitotic count. But now they've also added necrosis, so there was a revised. She revised her classification, and she adds necrosis as well as mitotic count. So that's the one we use. We tend to put that information. The clinicians like it, so we do.
Yeah, that's the one we're using as well.
So maybe... another one to consider doing it. We may be asked to do it. We'll see what our oncologists think, I guess. But at least it was a nice study. It was a good study, and it seems like it would be something easy to do and reproducible.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Any other comment?
We had a fair bit of discussion at the mesothelioma meeting. This other consensus document will be coming out on, but, you know, for as much as the consensus paper is going to propose grading, I have to say that on a practical level, no one's ever asked me for this information yet. So, you know, we're probably ahead of the clinic, or this is probably ahead of where the clinical, you know, the clinicians are.
Yeah. Right now, I guess it's true for probably everybody. Really, they really want to know the subtype. And for biphasic, they're asking us to even estimate the percentage of an epithelioid component. Other places?
Well, not
true here.
Okay.
I've had a couple of people ask me that exact issue, how much sarcomatoid is in there.
Yeah. And I think it's for their clinical trials and for eligibility.
One person told me at the outside that they use it as a criterion for determining whether a patient is a surgical candidate.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody's heard of that.
Yeah, I think similar here, or surgical candidate or eligibility for clinical trials, which includes surgery, so they have to kind of decide what branch they're going through. Yeah. Okay, so the next study is a combination of MTAP and VAP1 for distinguishing sarcomatoid mesothelioma from fibrous pleuritis. So that's kind of the constant dilemma we deal with clinically. Is it reactive or is it malignant spindle cell? And they chose the background, basically. They kind of go over the background that we're familiar with, VAP1 in combination of FISH for the loss of NP21, and making the point that FISH is not readily accessible to everybody, and if they could find another immunostain to help in terms of making that distinction, that would be very helpful. And basically, the protein of that that they focused on, which is localized on the chromosomal region of the NP21, is the MTAP gene. And there is an immunostain that they could use to stain for that, which for them is considered equivalent to looking at a loss of NP21 by FISH. And so they went and embarked on their study doing that. They had 30 cases of malignant mesothelioma that was either biphasic or sarcomatoid, and they had 17 cases of pleuritis that they confirm basically with a follow-up of over a year to show that both clinically and radiologically there was no progression over that year to something worse. So they felt that they indeed had cases of pleuritis. And then they just basically did IHC for BAP1 and MTAP, and also did the FISH for comparison, and did the analysis. So I kind of summarized the results in a table format. So they had 24 out of their 30 cases of malignant mesothelioma that showed loss of the MTAP, and BAP1 was even less sensitive with 11 loss. The FISH was the most sensitive in their study with a loss of 28 out of the 30. Most importantly, none of the pleuritis case showed any loss. And then when they did combination, their FISH and BAP1 combination was the best with 100% sensitivity and specificity, but they had basically their MTAP combination with BAP1 was not bad, with a sensitivity of 90% and specificity of 100 compared to the FISH BAP1, and certainly way above what my personal experiences, and I'll be curious to see what other people's personal experiences, but our FISH is no way close to that sensitivity. So that makes MTAP kind of appealing, I think, because our FISH, not only does it take 2-3 weeks to get our FISH results, but I don't remember a case where I had loss, and BAP1 is really not that sensitive. I don't know what people's experience is.
Our molecular lab validated use of the Eurovision tool for this problem, and actually the test characteristics were really good.
Oh, good.
We don't have much experience with that yet. We're just learning. It's just become available to us probably 2 months ago.
Okay.
But we really haven't been doing well. We do a lot of BAP on the sarcomatoids, but I agree with you. It hasn't proven very useful.
Right.
And so, do they go into how the MTAP correlates with the FISH? Because, I mean, they always say the MTAP is the poor man's FISH.
Let's see if there's a direct correlation. I don't recall a direct correlation except, I don't know what the difference between, like, there was 28 out of the 30 and 24 out of 30 MTAP versus FISH. Mm. So, like, the 6 that did not show any loss, I don't know if there has to be a couple that are picked up by the FISH, but I don't know if the 2 that are not lost by FISH are either not lost. So I don't know that direct. Oh, no, that's not true. Table 2. Sorry, Anya. In Table 2, they actually kind of go in which are lost versus preserved. So 2 out of the MTAP were preserved by the MTAP but were lost by the FISH.
I see. That's pretty good.
So at least I don't know for us that in Rochester. What about you guys in Arizona? What do you do?
Well, we've used your FISH occasionally, although not that much. My question, and we use BAP1, you know, but we send it up to you. We're hoping to bring it online maybe this year down here.
Right.
Did I hear that you're working on MTAP? Did someone?
Yeah, it's cooking.
Yeah. Okay.
And the validation is pretty much done. It's actually looking good, but, you know, the implementation always takes a little time.
Yeah. All right.
Andras, what do you do?
Not much.
Well, in fairness, can I ask, I mean, I guess I don't have a sense that this is very often a problem based on histology. I think we struggle more with epithelial proliferations, but I don't think we get stuck very often on this problem. Do you? Maybe you just see more of them than we do.
Yeah. I don't have a number about how often. Once in a while, we do it hoping. It's just that each time you do it, I think you remember those cases more because each time you do it hoping it's going to help you, it doesn't.
Yeah.
And then you're kind of stuck at where you started. So that stays probably more in your mind than all the times you don't need it and you kind of make the diagnosis and move on. I don't know. And I don't know what you're.
Yeah, no, exactly. But I also think cytology might be able to use it more. Right now, I mean, at least for us, if that one is lost, they call it highly suspicious. They don't usually go to malignant. But so maybe down the road that might be
even more useful for cytology.
Yeah, I would say I would tend to use it on those cases where you really think it's a desmoplastic, for example, and you don't have that invasion. Maybe you've got necrosis, but you're really looking for invasion to sort of seal the, you know, to seal the diagnosis. And then I would find it helpful. But again, in the case that I had not too long ago that I sent around to the mesothelioma panel, a limited sample, we actually did the FISH, which was lost, but I still couldn't get anybody to call it definitively meso. Everybody was highly suspicious because of the loss. You know, so hard cases are just hard, and sometimes the molecular, you know, isn't going to push a lot of people either.
Hmm. Fair enough. Okay. So good discussion. The next article is probably my least favorite, but it was one of the mesothelioma article. Pretty much a negative study, I guess. The authors were looking at identifying potential prognostic biomarkers in patients with malignant peritoneal mesothelioma, so really focusing on peritoneal mesothelioma. Their background is one of the protein, which is the insulin growth factor mRNA binding protein 3, is known to be expressed in several malignant tumors, and high expression would be associated with poor prognosis, and that protein has not been studied very well in peritoneal malignant mesothelioma. The other protein they looked at is FLY1, as FLY1 gene regulates vessel formation, invasion, and metastasis, and we're familiar with it for vascular tumors, but not expressed in mesothelioma. So basically with that background, they identified 44 patients with peritoneal malignant mesothelioma over 4 years. And this is an interesting T-staging that they've developed. So I kind of took the little graph from the study that they were referencing, because they didn't really go into detail in this paper. And they do what they call a peritoneal carcinomatosis index, although it's not really carcinoma, which is based on the extent of mesothelioma involving the different quadrants of the abdomen, and they give it a score, and they use that basically as their T, I guess. And at least it serves as determining extent of disease and one of the clinical parameters that they're using in terms of studying their multivariate analysis to see the impact of IMP3 and FLY1. And they also did a K67. And for the scoring for the immunostain, anything that had less than 5% positive cells were scored a 0. And everything above 50% positive cells were scored as a 3 with increments of 25% for 1 and 2. And they divided then the peritoneal mesothelioma in 4 groups, where 1 was IHC completely negative, 1 was IMP3 positive only, FLY1 positive only, and then both positive. And then they use a K67 to divide between low and high based on a 10% cutoff. Overall, their group of patients had an overall survival of 7 months, and basically almost all their cases were positive for FLY1, which is good for us to know if ever we have a differential diagnosis, to know that FLY1 is positive, can be positive in malignant mesothelioma. And the IMP3 was positive in about a little more over than half of the cases. There was no correlation between the immunoprofile, age, and sex. And there was a correlation between cases that were epithelioid versus non-epithelioid, where the epithelioid had a lower K67 and the non-epithelioid had a higher score for IMP3. In the multivariate analysis they did, the only indicator of poor prognosis was treatment and IMP3, and in that setting it was as negative, i.e. less than 5% tumor cells, and positive with anything above 5% tumor cells, and not with any other biomarker, including K67. So they recommend this biomarker as a prognostic, but I think this study has the same limitations as many studies that look at just a couple of biomarkers in an otherwise very complex tumor with a lot of things that can influence its behavior, including the tumor itself, basically. So I still like the grading study a little better in terms of that as potentially prognostication because of the variables used versus just one biomarker like this, but that's my own bias. I don't know if there's any comments.
I like your comments.
Okay. Okay. So the next study is a nice study that Kelly did. It was just looking at the link, potential link between peritoneal malignant mesothelioma and endometriosis. So they kind of started with a case study base where they identified a patient that had peritoneal mesothelioma and endometriosis, so they kind of went back either to their cases in-house or in their consult practice to see if they had more examples of this occurring together. And they had to identify patients that either by the clinical history and the GYN workup actually had, or by pathology, had proven endometriosis and also, of course, a diagnosis of peritoneal malignant mesothelioma. And they were able to identify six women, of course, a very small percentage, at least based on the consult practice of one of the authors. It was five out of 231 women, and women are usually also less often have mesothelioma, although maybe more in the peritoneum. And they were young women. So if they compared women that had both endometriosis and peritoneal malignant mesothelioma versus patients that had malignant mesothelioma without endometriosis, the patient with endometriosis tended to be younger by almost 14 years. The mesothelioma was more likely to be epithelioid. The immunoprofile was otherwise classic of mesothelioma with few exceptions. One case had very faint ERPR, and one case had weak MOC31, and at least for the MOC31, nothing surprising there. In three of their cases, it was a concurrent diagnosis based on pathology where they found in the biopsy or at least surgical past specimens both meso and endometriosis. And three had a prior diagnosis of endometriosis over 5 to 30 years before their diagnosis of malignant mesothelioma. Two might have had some kind of history of asbestos exposure, and they actually had lung in one of these patients on which they analyzed and looked for asbestos fibers, but they didn't see any. And they did not have a lot of information on treatment or outcome on these patients, and not surprising with a consult practice, we kind of know how that goes. What they did, though, is they actually did a search of the Social Security Death Index to try to find these patients to see if they were dead or alive. One was dead at 1 year, and five had not been recorded as dead 4 months to 12 years following diagnosis, kind of implying that maybe in this setting they have a much better prognosis than what you would expect. And then they kind of discuss that endometriosis being kind of an inflammatory or generating inflammation in the peritoneum can as serve as a precursor or at least a milieu in which malignant mesothelioma can develop in women. So it was just a nice observational study. And I guess something to look for when we have peritoneal mesothelioma in women or to think about.
Hey, Marie-Christine, what is the reason to think that there is any sort of cause and effect relationship here? I mean, I look at this and I guess I don't see that conclusion.
So, Jeff, I can speak to that. So, Dr. Rogley has been interested as of late in the research that's coming out more of the translational world in terms of better understanding the inflammasome in the non-asbestos factors in the development of mesothelioma. And so he's been doing what he can in terms of looking at potential non-asbestos triggers of mesothelioma. And so we've looked at things like various things that have irritated either the pleura or the peritoneum. We've looked at Crohn's disease, and there have been cases of familial Mediterranean fever with inflammation of the serosa that have later developed mesothelioma and things like that. So although it's certainly not by any means provable, it is interesting that there does an admittedly completely underpowered small observational study. There does seem to be some women with endometriosis and the spectrum of mesothelial lesions that now range from hyperplasia all the way to malignancy. And again, I fully admit this is just as Marie-Christine said, an observational study at this point. But
interesting. Thank you.
Yes. And thank you for including that article. That's very generous of you to do that.
Well, it fitted in my theme, and I thought it was a nice observation. So.
Thank you.
Kelly, it's an excellent article.
Oh, thank you. I would just say, since that time in my own practice here, I've seen an example of well-differentiated papillary mesothelioma in a patient with endometriosis, and there are a few reports of that in the literature. So if anybody just perks up their ears and happens to see any spectrum of mesothelial neoplasms with endometriosis, just keep that in mind. We could cobble something together potentially.
I was just trying to think about what a control group would look like if you were trying to understand whether this frequency is any different than the frequency with which you might find endometriosis in a sex and age matched control group who had some other cause for abdominal invasion or I don't know how you'd do that. It'd be hard to do, I guess.
Right. And what we did, right, exactly. Apparently there's some literature out of Italy that's kind of tried to get at the rates of endometriosis in women, say, in their 50s and try to do epidemiological type of studies. But again, it's always a difficult challenge.
I mean, what's a little intriguing to me is that often the peritoneal mesotheliomas occur in these younger women. I mean,
yes,
that's kind of intriguing with what you found.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the suggestive bit. I mean, it's always hard to tell what that means in a consultation practice, right? I mean, it's so biased, but it's interesting. It's certainly food for thought. It's cool. And I think one of the better papers we've talked about in a while. So,
thank you guys.
It's not a charity case, in my opinion.
Thank you.
So I guess the last one for the day, it's not focused just on mesothelioma. It was actually looking at overall The role of cytology in making a diagnosis of malignancy in the setting of unilateral pleural effusions. And the reason these authors chose to do such study is because when you look at the literature, there's a lot of variation in terms of whether or not cytology is useful in making a diagnosis in terms of its sensitivity. So they went and looked, basically, they did a prospective study, and they looked at consecutive patients with undiagnosed cause for their unilateral pleural effusion that all underwent thoracentesis, and they were followed up for 12 months or until death. And they were all basically investigated exactly the same way in terms of analyzing the pleural fluids, doing the cell counts, and any cases of pleural fluid that had any suspicious cells. They had their full immunohistochemical workup or full cytometry depending on the diagnosis. And as a rule, of course, everything that was quote-unquote non-diagnostic from a cytology perspective, because cytology was negative, but the clinical history was highly suggestive of malignancy, these were all followed with additional procedures for a diagnosis. So ultimately, a patient was deemed to have malignancy either because they had a positive cytology or it was one of those non-diagnostic that eventually was found to have a biopsy, or they were histologically confirmed with malignancy radiologically because of the evidence of the disease, or there was progression over time in the 12-month follow-up, or ultimately an autopsy that confirmed especially pleural malignancy. So they accumulated 921 patients over an eight-year period, and 56% of these were eventually confirmed with a diagnosis of malignancy over a 12-month follow-up. Not surprisingly, lung and mesothelioma were the two most common malignancies. But the study was nice because it kind of explains why there's so much variation in the literature, because based on the tumor type, of course, the sensitivity of the pleural effusions in making a diagnosis of malignancy varied anywhere between 0% to 95%. So, of course, tumors like sarcomas and melanomas, in their series at least, never got diagnosed on a pleural effusion, but ovarian carcinomas did almost all the time. So the primary tumor site, the cell type, so carcinoma versus sarcoma, generated were very important in determining what are the chances of your effusions being able to provide a diagnosis, and the overall mean sensitivity was 46.4%. And again, not surprisingly, if you just look at lung cancer, lung adenocarcinoma by far were more likely to be diagnosed on pleural effusion than a squamous was, and small cell were somewhere in between. And same thing for mesothelioma. Mesothelioma was unlikely to be diagnosed as mesothelioma in a pleural effusion, and almost all required a biopsy for a definitive diagnosis. But they did not use something like BAP1 in their panel. So I don't know if that would have changed anything in terms of how they would have called their diffusion. There's nothing new. If you kind of compile all the studies on cytology, which I don't do, but at least based on their discussion and background, but it was one study that shows it all in terms of looking at all tumor types and all primary sites in terms of the ability to make a diagnosis. So it's kind of informative that way in terms for likelihood of making or being able to make a diagnosis of meso on a cytology specimen. So with that, I don't know if there's any comments.
Sorry, MC, I need to go.
Okay.
It was an excellent conference. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye, Andras.
Can I ask a question? This is maybe obvious and well known, but is the variation in sensitivity a reflection of the biology of the diseases and the likelihood that they'll shed into the fluid, or does it reflect the difficulty in recognizing them as malignant?
They didn't go in too much detail, but they kind of alluded that it maybe it's a bit of both, but mostly because it was interesting that the sarcomas were, or maybe, yeah.
And melanoma. I would have thought melanoma would be easy.
Right.
But maybe they're just not there.
Right.
Okay.
That's a good question. They didn't really go in details of that.
Okay. Thank you. This was awesome.
Thank you much.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Bye.